May it please the court, I'm Sean Andrews Sear from Duke Law School, and I am pleased to introduce Duke Law student Emily May, who will present argument on behalf of the appellant John Lassane.
Thank you. Ms. May.
May it please the court, defendants moved for and obtained summary judgment in this case under the Prison Litigation Reform Act, a statute that they now agree only applies if the plaintiff is a prisoner at the time he files his action. Defendants also do not contest John Lassane's sworn declaration that he was not incarcerated when he brought this suit. This court should reverse the district court's summary judgment and hold that the Prison Litigation Reform Act does not apply to this action, even though the threshold question of statutory interpretation was not raised below. If the court resolves this statutory interpretation issue in Mr. Lassane's favor, it need not address Amicus's alternative argument that defendants failed to prove, as a matter of law, that the inmate grievance procedure was available to John Lassane. This court should decide whether summary judgment was based on an inapplicable statute because it is a threshold question of statutory interpretation.
Can I take you back to this basic waiver question?
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, the default rule here is, you know, if you don't raise an argument in the district court, it's waived. And there are exceptions to that, as you point out in your brief. But if we agree with you, how do we write an opinion that cabins this exception? In other words, what exception do you invoke? How do we do this in a way, if we agree with you, that we aren't, you know, opening or weakening the waiver doctrine?
Your Honor, this is an exceptional case because it involves an inapplicable statute invoked by the government against a pro se litigant. It's a threshold question of statutory interpretation. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, there are other factors here. The legal question is straightforward. No further factual development is required, and there will be no prejudice.
We have lots of cases like that, where you could argue that the question is just legal, no factual development needed. And as the district points out in its brief, we have several cases which suggest that the pro se, the fact that the appellant was pro se in the district court is not a factor where damages are at stake. Right.
We don't rely, Your Honor, on the fact that John Lassane was pro se, but we also don't think that factor is irrelevant. This circuit has not foreclosed the possibility of acknowledging someone's pro se status. For example, in Dozier versus Ford Motor Company, which the defendants cite, there in that case, this court said that the plaintiff did not necessarily get special status because he was pro se. And in that case, the plaintiff had alleged that he had over 30 years of legal experience, and this court referred to that. So although pro se, this court need not rely on John Lassane's pro se status, it's also not foreclosed, especially whereas here it's an inapplicable statute being raised against Mr. Lassane, and there is this threshold question of statutory interpretation. And addressing this question is appropriate because this court can address questions of statutory interpretation de novo. And there's no deference given to the district court's legal determination in this court. And here the question is straightforward, as every circuit that has addressed this issue has concluded, and it is a majority of circuits, the statute's meaning is plain, and defendants do not contest that plain meaning interpretation. So at least here, where the legal issue is a threshold question of statutory interpretation and where it is straightforward, this court can exercise its discretion.
Do we give any weight to the fact that this case bounced around between district court judges and that in granting the IFP, the first district court judge presumably credited the appellant's statement that he was at liberty?
No, Your Honor, this court should not give credit to the fact that there were numerous district court judges at issue, as you correctly point out, but rather the district court's determination as a whole. And when defendants moved for summary judgment in this case, there were only two documents in the record filed by Mr. Lassane. There was his 15-page complaint, and as you noted, Your Honor, his informa pauperis two-page application that the district court presumably accepted the declaration that he was not incarcerated and relied on that in deciding to accept his application to proceed without prepayment of filing fees.
So one judge grants that, accepting the declaration, then it goes to another judge who's just looking at summary judgment, and no one calls his attention, presumably, to documents in the record filed by the pro se litigant. Is that at all relevant?
No, Your Honor, because this is not a voluminous record. Simply, there were these two documents, and even if, putting aside the informa pauperis application, there were other indications that John Lassane's status should be looked at, indications that he was not incarcerated. For example, the affidavit that defendants submitted and upon which the district court relied in granting summary judgment noted that on April 25th, 2008, Mr. Lassane was released. There's also the fact that defendants certified that they served John Lassane at a private street address, Savannah Street, and not at a correctional facility. These indications...
So if the district court did all that and knew it, why is, you know, the matter not properly before it?
Before the district court, Your Honor?
Right.
Admittedly, John Lassane did not raise the question, but this is the type of question, based upon our research, the district courts have raised sua sponte and declining to grant summary judgment. And it's also, this question is also one that courts of appeals have addressed for the first time on appeal. For example, the Second Circuit in Gregg versus Gord, and the Eighth Circuit, which noted in Nearness versus Johnson that the plaintiff's status was ambiguous in the district court, but was then clear on appeal. So this is the type of question that, although the threshold question of statutory interpretation and the factual issue were not raised in the district court, that this court can decide. And defendants did have the opportunity to fully brief this issue. And in fact, they were on notice even before the opening brief, because this is the question that this court asked defendants and amicus to address. And defendants don't contend that they would be prejudiced, and they don't contend that...
Of course, when we asked that issue to be briefed, we didn't resolve the waiver question, did we?
No, Your Honor, you did not. That just goes to the policies underlying the forfeiture doctrine, the idea that litigants should not be unfairly surprised and that they need to be able to introduce evidence in the district court. But here, there was no indication. Defendants do not contend that...
But there's another really important value underlying the forfeiture doctrine, and that is that it forces parties to raise issues first in the district court.
Yes, Your Honor, and we certainly...
Right. No, go ahead.
We certainly do not contest the general rule. Rather, we argue that this is a case that does present exceptional circumstances, and this is the type of issue that, even if it were addressed in the district court and were now up in this court on appeal, that this court would not give deference to the district court's legal determination. And there's no factual issue in dispute here. There is the informa pauperis application, and also defendants could have introduced evidence. It was their burden in moving for summary judgment on their affirmative defense to establish that John Lassane was incarcerated at the time of filing and thus was subject to the statute, but they did not do that. They did not introduce any evidence for Mr. Lassane to rebut on that question.
So is your argument that accepting your position, this court would simply be applying its precedent, for example, in Prime Time and Air Florida, and that those factors you've named are the factors the court has identified?
Yes, Your Honor. And
so we would not be going, extending the exception further? That's really my question.
Exactly, Your Honor. There's no factor that we articulate that is novel, and that these are the factors that this court has relied upon repeatedly. And it is remarkable here that although this court does not require that every factor be present when deciding to address an issue for the first time on appeal, here many of the factors are present. A straightforward legal issue that doesn't require any further factual development, no prejudice to the parties, and it is this threshold issue of statutory interpretation. And turning to the statutory interpretation issue, the statute's meaning is plain. The PLRA only applies if the action is brought by a prisoner who is confined in a correctional facility, and the plaintiff's status is determined at the time of filing. And as I noted earlier, as we're aware, every circuit that has addressed this issue has adopted this plain meaning interpretation. Moreover, several circuits have recognized that the statute's purpose, in looking at the legislative history, the statute's purpose is consistent with this plain meaning interpretation. Congress was targeting idle prisoners who have everything to gain and nothing to lose by filing lawsuits from prison. And so here this court should decide this threshold issue of statutory interpretation and accept the plain meaning interpretation and hold that this the PLRA does not apply to this action. And if the court decides the statutory interpretation issue in Mr. Lissane's favor, it need not address our alternative argument. Nevertheless, I present that unavailability argument now.
Before you do that, plaintiff has some state law claims too, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
But they're not before us. You didn't raise them in your brief.
Your Honor, we did
so
not.
So they're waived, correct?
Well, we did not brief as amicus
right. The
intentional infliction of emotional distress claims. We really see this more as a deliberate indifference.
I understand, but does that mean they're waived?
Your Honor, Mr. Lissane did file an original pro se brief, and to the extent that they're raised there.
Are they raised there?
Not clearly, Your Honor. We conferred with Mr.
You think they're clearly enough for us to hear them?
Your Honor, we didn't brief those issues, and there are.
Let me ask you, in your reply brief, you state that you were appointed and ordered to brief the statutory interpretation issue. Did you interpret that to mean that the court did not want you to address the local law claim?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, because we also briefed this unavailability claim.
So then why didn't you address the local law claim?
Yes, Your Honor, because we see this as a deliberate indifferent case, and speaking for a moment about
your client presented a pro se brief where at least he outlined that as one of the issues he wished to raise.
Yes, Your Honor, he did raise that as an issue, but he didn't make a clear argument about it in his pro se.
But I'm trying to understand, he didn't, but you had the opportunity to do that on his behalf.
Yes, Your Honor, and the reason that we did not raise the local law claims are because, one, we looked at the notice letter, 12309, and that letter does not refer to any incident specifically enough at the jail. And so
you decided it wasn't a claim that would be worth pursuing on appeal? You went to the merits of the claim in terms of its procedural deficiency?
Your Honor, we did look at the merits, and there is a possibility that with respect to the hospital claim, there might be some intentional infliction of emotional distress, and it should survive at least the pleading stage. This was dismissed on a 12B6 motion, but we did decide to focus on the federal claims and on the deliberate indifference, and we did let Mr. Lissane know that if he wanted to pursue these local law claims, that he could do so and that he should file a brief if
Another
he chose.
Brief.
Yes, Your Honor, but he decided not to.
And you're making that representation as his counsel to this court, and we can therefore rely on it?
Yes, Your Honor. I was in the room when Professor Andrew Sear was talking to Mr. Lissane, and we did confer with him. And we are making the representation that we did confer with him and let him know that he could file a brief on that issue if he chose. Turning now to the issue of unavailability, summary judgment on Mr. Lissane's availability argument was improper because defendants failed to carry their burden of proving as a matter of law that the IGP was available to Mr. Lissane. And unless there are questions on that now, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Wilson?
Good morning, and if it pleases the court, I'm Mary Wilson, representing the District of Columbia Appellees. The plaintiff is not entitled to reversal here because he did not preserve the issues he raises on appeal.
So the district's position is that, make sure I get this, the district's position is that we should affirm a judgment that the district concedes rests on a flat-out improper interpretation of the PLRA, right?
Yes.
Okay. I guess the follow-up question is, why should we do that, and do you know of a court that ever has?
As Your Honor's questioning pointed out, this is a basic case where waiver or forfeiture should apply.
But waiver is not rigid.
No, it
and
is
we
not.
We have exceptions to waiver, and Supreme Court has said, rules of practice and procedure are devised to promote the ends of justice, not to defeat them. So how does invoking waiver here promote the ends of justice in the limited context of this case?
Yes.
Where the district concedes that the judgment rests on a misinterpretation of statute.
When the district filed its summary judgment motion based on the premise that the PLRA applied here, it was the plaintiff's burden to come forth and say why the district was wrong.
You're just going back to waiver now. You're just saying he waived it, which we agree he did. There's no doubt he didn't raise it. I'm asking you a different question. In what way are we promoting the ends of justice? Invoking forfeiture here and affirming a judgment that even you agree is based on a flawed interpretation of the statute. And it's not
the
even
forfeiture
close.
Rule is frequently applied where it works a hardship on the plaintiff.
But do you know of a case like this where we...
I don't know of a case like this.
Right. Because I looked, I couldn't find one.
I don't know. Yeah. But the policy behind the rule... Uh-huh. Is that you would have confusion and endless delay if a party could appeal and issues not presented to the court. And
right.
The plaintiff here never squarely said the district is wrong. He went based on the assumption that the PLRA applied. That was what the district court had to rule on below. That was the first round of briefing in this court before amicus was appointed. So if the purpose of the rule is just to promote the smooth administration and operation of the courts, you can't allow pro se plaintiffs to this case simply does not present in an exceptional circumstance, even though the district now agrees of the proper interpretation of the law. I mean, the court can write its opinion to reach the legal issue and then say, but that issue was forfeited in this case.
Wait, what would we do? Explain that to me. How would we do that? We would say it's waived, but we decide it anyway?
Well, waiver is not a jurisdictional issue.
Right.
The court can address the meaning of the PLRA, so this problem does not arise again, but then say, but...
Oh, so I get it. So we would have a holding. I think you're making your case worse. So what you want us to do is write an opinion where we hold that the statute does not apply to people who are not in prison, right? But yet affirm?
Yes, because this is a basic forfeiture waiver case where the plaintiff...
Do you know of a case where we've ever done anything like that? Usually when an issue is forfeited, we don't go ahead and decide it.
Well, the closest I could come with an example of reaching the legal issue but ruling it doesn't apply in this case is an old case that I argued over 20 years ago, Spiegler, S-P-E-G-L-E-R.
That was before I got here. What was it?
Spiegler. It was a case that involved the statute of limitations in special education cases.
Uh-huh.
And the court ruled that there was a 30-day statute of limitations, reached that legal issue, but then said based on equitable concerns would not apply it in that case. And the court can do a similar thing here. Reach the legal issue about what the PLRA means and then apply the basic rule that the plaintiff cannot benefit from that ruling because he never raised it below.
Cite to that case? It's in your brief.
No, it's not in my brief. It's Spiegler, S-P-I-E-G-L-E-R, and it involved the Education for the Handicapped Act case, mm-hmm. Statute.
So is it still your position also that it's not clear whether the plaintiff was in prison at the time? That this is a fact question?
No.
You're not taking that position anymore?
The district does not dispute at this point that he was not incarcerated when he filed his complaint.
Right.
But there is no compelling reason why he should be able to present this issue for the first time in appeal. This is not an exceptional case. This is a routine case The waiver rule is applied to pro se prisoners. It's applied to the district when the public fisc is at stake. It's routinely applied in cases like this. He simply was not allowed to stay silent in the district court when these when the district filed its motion, and then get two rounds of briefing in this court before the issue was raised, and then benefit from that. If there are no other questions, we would submit on the other issues on our brief.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Does Ms. May have any time?
Ms. May had one.
All right.
May it please the court, a few points in response to defendant's argument. First, Judge Rogers, earlier you invoked primetime, and here this case can be analogized to the primetime case, and this court should decide the question, because here where defendants concede the legal issue and now concede that there is no factual issue, this question is beyond any doubt, so this court can reach it.
What about the public fisc argument?
Your Honor, the public fisc argument? Well, here where, if I understand your question, the idea that the district court should have the opportunity to raise and address the issue before it reaches the Court of Appeals. Is that your?
Yeah, I'm dealing with its forfeiture. We're dealing, you're citing prime time, and counsel for the District of Columbia said this is a run-of-the-mill type case, and it involves the public fisc. If the plaintiff wins and recovers damages, the District of Columbia government will have to pay him money.
Yes, Your Honor. I see my time has expired. May I respond to your question? Your Honor, this is not the run-of-a-mill type of case. Here, failing to reach this issue would result in injustice. This is the government invoking an inapplicable statute that they now agree does not apply to John Lassane, but holding that he still cannot benefit from this ruling. And the purpose of the forfeiture rule is to avoid having to address these questions. But if defendants concede and suggest that this court should address the question but not let Mr. Lassane benefit, there's no equitable reason to do that, Your Honor. And this court should reverse the summary judgment because this case should not be decided on the basis of an inapplicable statute. Thank you.
All right, Ms. May, as Mr. Anderson pointed out, you were appointed to represent Mr. Lassane. We're always delighted to have you all come from Duke Law School. Did a good job. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.